Roy Blount Jr. For the king of country rock, nothing beats getting unconscious on stage, because that's when he sings the best. One balmy night on the Isle of Kauai, Jerry Jeff Walker, the modern cowboy singer, came out of a bar and couldn't get into his rent-a-car, so he started banging away at it with a heavy wooden chair. Then an outraged Kauaian appeared. Jerry Jeff had the wrong car. How do you explain to somebody why you are heatedly attacking his automobile with a chair? How indeed does anyone explain anything Jerry Jeff does? I have been with him in Phoenix, in Tucson, in New York City, in his house outside Austin, in hill country rain, and in several bars, motel rooms, stupors, performance halls, quandaries, vehicles, and middles of the night, and even on stage. And I have lived to tell the story. And the story is, Jerry Jeff feels most like himself when, in his words, he is unconscious on stage. Who is Jerry Jeff that we should be so mindful of his unconscious? He may come from upstate New York, but he reached Texas, both Austin and Leukenbach, before Willie Nelson did, and he has stayed on. He is not the meticulous artist Willie is, but Jerry Jeff's are the grabbiest versions of several songs without which Texas would be poorer and quieter. Guy Clark's L.A. Freeway, Ray Wiley Hubbard's Up Against the Wall, Redneck, Gary P. Nunn's London Homesick Blues, his own Hill Country Rain, and if anybody is a pioneer and exemplar of the Austin sound, it is Jerry Jeff. The folk rock country desperado image he presents has been too elusive to gain him superstardom, but his albums sell steadily around the country. There runs through all of his varied numbers a progressively less lilting but consistently engaging and unmistakable voice. Furthermore, he has established a truly distinguished standard of modern musical cowboy misbehavior. Not long ago, Jerry Jeff telephoned my home in Massachusetts to report that he would be appearing in nearby Hartford the next weekend. My wife and I were out. Our friend Rose took the message. "Where exactly in Hartford are you going to be?" she asked. "I don't know," said Jerry Jeff. "Where exactly am I now?" Since there are no telephones in drunk tanks or on the ground beneath motorcycle boots, Jerry Jeff was presumably in neither of those places. Nor was he likely to be in the White House. Last year he showed up there at Jimmy Carter's invitation, but after cooling his heels for 2 hours, some presidential crisis graver than Jerry Jeff's presence having arisen, he walked out saying, "I guess the president and I aren't going to get together because I'm not hanging around this place any longer, and I hear he don't hang out in any bars." Jerry Jeff just might have been, strangely enough, in repose, abed in what his wife, Susan, calls the Howard Hughes room of their ranch house outside Austin. There he sometimes relaxes these days with his baby girl, Jessie, at his side, several vials of a restorative ginseng and bee saliva solution handy, an oxygen mask on his face, and preferably Monday Night Football on television. Not that Jerry Jeff has become, by ordinary standards, domestic. After Susan and the baby came home from the hospital, he absented himself to a friend's house for a while, saying that he didn't feel quite right at home. When he did show up to take on paternity, he stayed just long enough to voice some firm opinions about how a baby should be held and what a baby ought to listen to. Then he went off on his motorcycle to get some formula and was gone for 3 days. Members of the band say he is mellowing. He hardly ever misses gigs anymore, and he drinks less, which says a lot about how much he used to drink. "Like everybody else, he's getting older," says Susan, a good-looking woman with flashing eyes who is known to yell and throw fits, but who continues, after 4 years with Jerry Jeff, to regard him steadily, hard-headedly, and with pride. One night he insisted she come up on stage with him as he sang Derby Day, his fond tribute to her. So she came to his side. He turned to her in mid-note, and she was wearing a wig and an artificial nose. But Susan loves that song. She doesn't see how anybody can hear Jerry Jeff's music and dismiss him as crazy. At the Bottom Line in New York, I sat with Susan as Jerry Jeff performed. "Is he mellowing out?" I asked her. "Either that," she said with delight, "or he's up to something." We watched Jerry Jeff working well with his talented rock and roll band. He had been up drinking for 36 hours. But his set so far was tight. The crowd was loving it. He had a faraway yet engaged, suffering yet grinning look on his beaked, heavy-lidded face. His pot belly was thrusting in tempo. He was unconscious. When a person is unconscious and singing as he is, as Keats puts it, capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, and without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. The same can often be said of a person who is simply drunk and singing, and Jerry Jeff is often drunk. If he hadn't been capable of carrying on through certain uncertainties, he would never have become a Texas legend from Oneonta, New York. Jerry Jeff was born in that backwater town 37 years ago under the name of Ronald Clyde Crosby. He shook Oneonta and his name in his late teens when he took off hitchhiking around the country and making music. Jerry came from his drinking ID. Jeff, he thinks maybe, the movie star Jeff Chandler, and Walker from either a musician named Kirby Walker or the movie star Robert Walker. Sometimes he also goes by Jackie Jack, a name with an edgy, obsessive, good time ring. In his early days as a folky in New Orleans and New York coffee houses, he performed as Happy Guitar or Mr. Bojangles, the latter name in honor of his best known composition. Jerry Jeff is known for raucous country rock, but he has a penchant for long, over-poetic ballads. He sings about freedom, and yet he has frequently gotten himself arrested, 25 times, he estimates, for driving while intoxicated alone. People who have played basketball with him or been through tense moments in his company attest to his physical strength, agility, stamina, and daring. But he is famous for falling off stages, and when he gets into a fist fight, as he frequently does, he never hits a man. Once, when he was getting stomped by a motorcycle gang, he yelled up at his attackers, "You don't fight as good as rodeo cowboys." Or it may have been the other way around. Or both ways. Jerry Jeff once even nagged Pacific Willie Nelson into decking him. He kept picking up Willie's sacred acoustic guitar, the one with the holes strummed into it over the years, and Willie kept saying, "Leave that alone, Jerry Jeff, I mean it," and getting madder and madder until he knocked Jerry Jeff, who was considerably larger, flat with one punch. "I remember you," said Jerry Jeff from the floor. "You're the one who knocked me down last night." "A lot of times he invites to get hit," said Bobby Rambo, his lead guitarist, "but he never hits back," answers someone else in the band. "Well, I think he might if he's right." "Yeah, but he's never right." "Well, that's true." Jerry Jeff will hit a woman. His former girlfriend, Murphy, was a strapping and handsome woman who could lick him, but he has been known to hit smaller women, too. There are a number of ways in which Jerry Jeff is not a hero. However, he is one of the few recorded Americans who have managed to keep anybody from telling them how to record. One company for which he was doing an early album tried to dictate the way it should sound. "I want it to sound like me," Jerry Jeff said. "We are not making," the company man said stiffly, "a demo." That was it for Jerry Jeff with that company. Now he gets a budget from whatever firm he has a contract with, and he takes the money to Austin, Luckenbach, Key West, or somewhere. With the help of the band, manager and producer, Michael Brovsky, and whatever friends happen along, and in one case some chickens, He puts together something that these days is a semi-precious thing, a personal album. Not necessarily a masterful album, Viva Terlingua, which has sold over 500,000 copies, sounds very much like it was recorded live in a Luckenbach Bear Hall, which it was. One whole side of his double record album, A Man Must Carry On, which has sold over 300,000 copies, is devoted to songs and poems memorializing Hondo Crouch, the mayor of Luckenbach, who died just before the album was released and who was Jerry Jeff's friend. About the most complimentary thing that can be said about the songs, and especially the poems, is that they are of limited interest. But how many other people in show business would devote a fourth of an album to a dead friend? On stage or off, he hates being made to feel self-conscious or observed. You go somewhere and everybody's watching you to find out what they ought to start doing after you leave. His response in this kind of social situation is not bland. He was once invited over to a friend's home for a group picking and singing, but on arrival found a lot of people sitting around asking him to do something. So he dipped his hat into the host's big fish tank and began scooping up water and tropical fish and flinging them about the parlor. Friends of Jerry Jeff's suggest that he sometimes acts like a cartoon character to preserve his image. Some other singers get on Jerry Jeff sometimes, a friend says, telling him he's not crazy, he's not entitled to sing country, he hasn't been through enough. That probably works on him, that probably pushes him a little bit. But he's not crazy, he knows what he's doing. To us, he's just one of the band, says his saxophone player Tomas Ramirez. For the last 3 years, Jerry Jeff has traveled with a new, improved set of musicians who not only enjoy him, but don't beat him up or unplug his guitar, as did their predecessors, the Lost Gonzos. He also has a new recording contract with Elektra Asylum, which has convinced the long-suffering Brovsky, who once changed all the locks in his Free Flow Productions offices in Austin so Jerry Jeff couldn't enter them unilaterally, that this record company regards Jerry Jeff not as a weirdo, but as a potential superstar. There is only so mad you can get at him, says Ramirez of Jerry Jeff, but some people disagree. Once when he had sat up all night at some friend's house, the friend's 14 and 15-year-old boys, who were about to leave for school, came into the living room to meet their hero. "You're not really going to school," says Jerry Jeff. "You're going to..." And then he said something really vile, says the boy's mother, who is not easily offended. The boys just stood there. It was awful. You just don't talk to kids that way. Maybe it would be funny, one kid to another, away from adults, but there are times when a man really ought to be self-conscious enough to acknowledge that in some ways he has grown up. With this in mind, I asked him whether having a baby was settling him down. "It'll probably just make me crazier," he said, "because I'll care more about what I'm doing." By that, he meant getting unconscious. Before hooking up with Jerry Jeff in Phoenix, I had never been on the road with a band of Texas country rockers. It turned out that Jerry Jeff's band, Rambo, Ramirez, Ron Cobb, Reese Winans, Leo LeBlanc, Fred Crick, didn't look like cowboys at all. They looked like young hippie musicians, except for pedal steel player LeBlanc, who looked like a cross between a Burgermeister and an elf, and who wore a pork pie hat with a feather in it. They did whoop, but they also talked a lot about sound systems, monitors, triamps, dynamics, twin reverbs, and things like that. The audio texture of Jerry Jeff's current show is a complicated fabric. The voluminous folds of the electric instruments, the stitching of Jerry Jeff's between-song mumbles, the burlap of his low notes, the vinyl of his high notes, and what critic Robert Palmer has approvingly called the frayed living room rug of his middle range. And the night I met them backstage in the Celebrity Theater, the sound was not right. The crowd seemed satisfied, but the crowd also seemed stoned. And what Jerry Jeff said between songs was mostly inaudible. Jerry Jeff has always been known for raggedly unprogrammed music, and his approach is still improvisatory. He and his band have never yet rehearsed. He got them all together for the first time 3 years ago in a club in Aspen, where they were supposed to have a chance to work out their act. But the owner of the place sold the house out at $8 a head, and they had to learn the songs and get to know each other in concert. Sometimes now a couple of sidemen will grab a moment in between songs to coordinate licks in advance. "There goes the band, arranging again," Jerry Jeff will tell the crowd with asperity. They never know what songs are going to be played. They just wait until he gets going on one. He doesn't like to count off. And then come in gamely and freewheelingly behind him. But the new band takes rock sound more seriously than did the Gonzos, who were more into country fury. The heart of the act, when the act works, is still Jerry Jeff's earnest or jocular, often slurred, but still edgily intended words. The ungainly semi-grace of his physical dips and didos, and his various impervious, clowning, vexed, meditative, pained, wasted, whoop-de-doing point of view. But the band's dynamics compensate for the limitations and occasional strayings of Jerry Jeff's abused vocal equipment, and those dynamics need to be mic'd right. "I can go into a jungle joint and relax and play, and everybody has a good time," Jerry Jeff says. "But in these good places with the good sound systems, it's harder. It's got to be right." Jerry Jeff feels more pressure than his image would suggest. "I ate, I slept, I did everything," Jerry Jeff griped at one point on the tour. Slowing down long enough to go to bed and have a meal before a show is Jerry Jeff's idea of monkish propriety. He was damned if he would persist in self-denial if all he was going to get out of it was a show in which he didn't get unconscious. So for the next 28 hours or so, after the Phoenix show, we worked ourselves into a waking dream state. The first thing we did was stay up all night in Jerry Jeff's motel room debating the following topics: whether Jerry Jeff was going to tour England and Japan and Australia, whether Jerry Jeff was going to appear in New York if he couldn't get on Saturday Night Live, and whether Jerry Jeff was going to sell his Jaguar and his Mercedes. A motel security man was on hand, presumably to protect the motel from Jerry Jeff, but he was ignored. So was nearly everyone else except Jerry Jeff, but the debaters included Brofsky and his free-flow colleague Whit Stewart. The part about the Mercedes and the Jaguar went on for at least 4 hours, and the only conclusion I derived from it was that the difference between an average country person and a country music star is that the latter has more and fancier cars that won't crank. Jerry Jeff kept complaining about how many vehicles he had, something like 12, and that only the pickup worked. The question of whether to go to Japan arose, and Jerry Jeff considered the pros. "At least if the band got lost, I'd be able to find them in a crowd." And the cons: raw fish, raw fish. And just as it seemed, after an hour or two, that Brofsky and Stewart had talked him into it, he announced with an almost Churchillian resolve, "I still won't go." He didn't care that people adored him in Australia. "I hate adoration. One guy said I was one of the smartest guys he knew, and then he jumped right in the middle of my guitar." "Well, how about buying an airplane?" Brofsky suggests. "All right," said Jerry Jeff. "And if it'll make it to, say, Texarkana, we'll go for Ireland." Apparently, this is pretty much the way Jerry Jeff works out his business affairs. Recurring motifs this particular night were his feeling that he ought to be marketed at least as broadly as Elton John, and his feeling that he didn't ever again want to leave Texas, where folks accepted him as a neighbor. As he debated, Jerry Jeff blew snot on the floor. "I've never been around anyone with such a facility for clearing his nose. I have a lot of mucus," he says. "It's a mannerism. one of those mannerisms people have. I started doing it in motels, on rugs where it doesn't make any difference, but in people's houses they can't handle it. I'm trying to wipe it on my leg now. Jerry Jeff's nose is a big part of him. He talks about his nose for trouble, and there is no telling how often he has gotten it broken. One of the big differences between Jerry Jeff and Willie Nelson is that Willie, for the sake of his voice, preserves his nose. There are students of Jerry Jeff's music who say his voice hasn't been the same since he had his fist and drug abused nose fixed a few years back. His nose makes him resemble, just faintly, and he won't like this, having nearly shot out of his television a couple of times when the man was on it, Jim Nabors. Jerry Jeff's nose helps to keep him from looking like a serious cowboy. It doesn't keep him from ever looking serious, though. As that night in Phoenix wore on and Jerry Jeff got warier and more resistant to persuasion, he looked more and more like Billy Martin, the baseball manager, who also has a nose for trouble. The wrangling went on and on. The band, the road crew, the security man, one by one, went off to bed. And the sun rose, and the last of the scotch went down. And those of us who were left wandered out into the dry Arizona daylight, leaned against some of those little trees they have in Arizona. And Jerry Jeff said to Brovsky, "My wife Susan, who's so pretty, who's so smart, who's only done one thing wrong, and that was when she married me, wants to know what I'm going to do. And I can't look foolish in her eyes." Jerry Jeff doesn't talk readily about his childhood or his parents. He does refute the argument, sometimes advanced by Texas peers, that being from New York, he lacks a country western background. "I did all the same things you guys did. Listened to the Everly Brothers, learned to play ball, learned to drive a car, and left." He didn't like high school, which he says he never exactly finished. "My parents were good people. They paid the bills and did what you have to do. My father worked bars, sold liquor. They were dance champions, traveling around, following music. But when they were 19, they had me and quit. They sacrificed. When I got old enough, I said thank you, goodbye." His grandfather, who had a square dance band, is the relative Jerry Jeff speaks of most comfortably. He'd be lying there, and he'd take off his shoes and attach the ground wire to his toe, and we'd listen to the ball game on the radio. It was his grandfather about whom he wrote, "My old man," which began, "My old man, he had a rounder soul. He'd hear an old freight train, and then he'd have to go," and ends sadly and vaguely, "And all that I recall and said when I was young, no one else could really sing the songs he sung." Unimpeachable, philosophical, touching, performing, independent old men have been as important in Jerry Jeff's life and music as cold-hearted women were in Hank Williams's. His grandfather, Mr. Bojangles, Hondo Crouch, even ageless Willie Nelson, these are the people he seems to want to live up to, and he regards them with affection and awe. Next to them, he is still a kid. Sometimes he will say to someone slightly his senior, "You're older than I am, but I've been up more hours." Maybe he is trying to go directly from teenage to old age. His daughter might change that, but Susan says he can't wait for her to be a teenager so that he can get that 1956 T-Bird he always wanted. And he and his mother still break each other's hearts. When a story in New Times portrayed Jerry Jeff primarily as a man who pisses in beer pitchers and falls into drum sets while performing, his mother somehow saw it in Oneonta and called him up crying. I told her, "Whatever I do what I do, but just don't let it hurt you." That conversation still weighs on his mind. After a good night of arguing, Jerry Jeff seemed to feel refreshed, and we set out for Tucson at 10 in the morning. Since Tucson is only about 120 miles from Phoenix, and the show in Tucson wasn't until 8:30 that evening, we had a good shot at getting there on time. But drinking with no sleep eventually puts you on a plane where life is simple and hard, you are doing well to focus on more than about one and a half things at once. So life is simple. You feel as though your body cavities have been stuffed with oily rags, so life is hard. Most of America's great music has sprung from conditions that were simple and hard. Even so, you wouldn't think it would be part of the American dream to recreate painful conditions, but it is. And after you're on that plane for a while, you begin to glide. We took off in two carloads. The one I was in with Jerry Jeff and several band members stopped in several bars before we got out of Phoenix. In one of them, Jerry Jeff met a couple of guys, one of whom was named Ape, and he decided to go to another bar with them. Jerry Jeff got an Ape's friend's van and headed off, and I jumped in with Ape, who was following them in our rent-a-car. Then I got a good look at Ape. He was a monumental person in a black leather jacket with a lot of long black hair growing out of various parts of his face and head. "You can call me Ape or the Ape Man," he said. "No other names." Well, when we got to this other bar, Jerry Jeff was passed out cold in the van. Shaking him and yelling at him didn't come anywhere near waking him up. Ape and the other guy and I went into the bar for a while, and then we decided for some reason to take Jerry Jeff's remains over to still another bar. Not until we reached this bar did Ape's friend, who followed us in the van, inform us that Jerry Jeff was no longer in the van. Now I had no idea where Jerry Jeff was. I also had no idea where I was. Ape decided something fishy was going on. He jerked his friend the van driver around a little, and then Ape and I went into another bar and visited the homes of a couple of Ape's friends, one of whom, no doubt quite innocently, kept flicking a big knife open and shut. I think we made a lot of phone calls, too. Then we returned to the bar where we'd left the band members, and I sheepishly advised them that we had lost Jerry Jeff. "Don't worry about it," they chorused. "He does this all the time." By now, we were running a little late. I thought we ought to stop by the bar in whose parking lot I had last seen Jerry Jeff. As it happened, we discovered him in that bar, having a reasonably good time drinking with some people who were maybe going to drive him to Tucson. The next thing I knew, Ape was driving the band guys away at a tremendous rate of speed, and Jerry Jeff and some other people and I were in another car, vaguely Tucson-bound. On the way, we drank a good deal from a bottle in which Jerry Jeff had mixed scotch and ginger ale. None of us knew exactly where the auditorium was. At one point, we saw a sign to El Paso. I remember spending what seemed like an hour getting advice in a gas station. Jerry Jeff was not real alert in the back seat. But we were up. We were up. We were hurtling through the Arizona night, heedless, unafraid, amusing, incredibly drunk, and functioning, sort of. Suddenly, against all odds, we hit Tucson, and Jerry Jeff lurched to attention and croaked out the directions that had just occurred to him. And the next thing I knew, we were on stage. The right stage. Out there in front of us was a big, young, drunk, yelling audience. Jerry Jeff is ambivalent about his audiences. "Sometimes they get too drunk," he says, "and they are too young, and they are not sufficiently discriminating." His band says he wishes that his audiences would shut up and listen, the way Willie's do, when he shifts from one of his hard-driving rousers to a tender ballad. Once, before a performance, he accidentally took some synthetic marijuana, something he eschews even in a natural form because it makes him sleepy. "Great," said the promoter afterward. For once, Jerry Jeff was taken aback. "But I was hopping like a kangaroo," he said. "That's what they like," said the promoter. In Tucson, Jerry Jeff was geared for that kind of audience. He played Redneck Mother. He played Lonesome Homesick Blues. He played Hill Country Rain. With those words that come to mind whenever I think of Jerry Jeff. I've got a feeling, something that I can't explain. He played Pissin' in the Wind twice. The crowd seemed to be having the best time anybody has had in Tucson in years. That was my impression, at least. I was unconscious on stage. Jerry Jeff believes I sang in the show on There Ain't No Instant Replays in the Football Game of Life. But since I can't sing and don't know the words to that song, I doubt it. I may well have hummed along, because I remember a certain amount of consternation and murmurs of, "What mic is he on?" arising from the band. As for Jerry Jeff, he played his electric guitar for the folk so hard that his untaped broken right hand, he fractured it punching a storm glass window after seeing too many rainbows in Hawaii, got all ripped up. Critic Mary Freeman's review in the Tucson Citizen the next morning carried this headline: "Jerry Jeff's sought image exposed by perfect show." The review said in part, "Jerry Jeff Walker scrounged up his grungiest denims, staggered in through the side door an hour late, and generally worked hard at maintaining his image for some 1,500 at the Tucson Community Center Music Hall last night. By 8:30 p.m., with no signs of life coming from the stage, rumors began to buzz. Jerry Jeff's drunk somewhere, you know how he is. At 9 p.m., his band started up. Bobby Randall, Rambo, took the lead. He's somewhere between here and Phoenix, Randall assured the crowd. Guess who wandered in from the side exit? The crowd went wild. JJ staggered. He kept his back to the audience. Boy, is he blitzed, really stoned. Jerry Jeff Walker was a fraud last night. Stoned? Yes, stone cold sober. It was an act. It was part of the image. It was all for a good time. Everybody got his money's worth. This last sentence particularly amused the troupe the next day, inasmuch as the promoter had left without paying them. A more perfectly staged and timed show has rarely been seen by these eyes. Walker had his voice tuned down to its graveliest. In his studied uncoordination, he bumbled and mumbled. He played the part to the hilt. He kept a benign, stupid grin on his face from start to finish, oozing the charm usually reserved for the truly besotted. Well, that review tickled Jerry Jeff and his troopers to no end. The show had not, in fact, been what you could call musically tight, and it had been truly besotted. But there was something fitting about the review anyway. Some inconsolable compound of Jerry Jeff and his image had come through the wreckage. I think Jerry Jeff had got unconscious.
Hi, this is Linda. The Ballad of Billy Joe Shaver. In his 64 years, the Corsicana native has been a cotton picker and a roughneck, a screw-up and a scoundrel. He's hit the bottle, hit rock bottom, and been born again. He married the same woman 3 times, mounted multiple comebacks, survived a heart attack on stage, and the deaths of nearly everyone he's ever loved. All of which explains why he's one of the greatest songwriters in the world. By Michael Hall, originally published in the December 2003 issue of Texas Monthly. Billy Joe Shaver acts more like a Baptist preacher than a man in need of salvation. Performing at Austin's KUT-FM studios, he waves his arms around as if he were trying to explain something. He pounds his chest and kicks his leg out. He clasps his hands like a minister, throws punches like a fighter. 1 minute he's standing still, slightly tilted to the left, hands in his pockets, eyes slammed shut as he sings, deep worry lines between his brows. The next minute he's so riled up his face burns bright red. He stretches out his long arms as wide as they can go, revealing that the index and middle fingers on his right hand are stubs and the ring finger is missing a joint. He can't hold a pick. And when he plucks his guitar, he uses his thumb and pinky. Billy Joe, who is 64, is wearing blue jeans, a blue denim shirt, brown boots, and a brown cowboy hat, which, when he takes it off to wave in the air, sets his longish gray hair loose. He looks like a crazed George Washington, gesturing at the ceiling, clenching his fist. The funny thing is, he's singing to a radio audience that can't see any of this. Here in the studio at the University of Texas at Austin, there are only three people besides Billy Joe's four-piece band, which he is leading through a one-hour set of songs about love and death and trains and trouble. He does some good-natured preaching and storytelling. He introduces one of his best-known songs by saying, "This is a song that helped me when I was at the end of my rope. It's called, I'm Just an Old Chunk of Coal, but I'm Gonna Be a Diamond Someday." After a beat of dead air, he adds, "Still trying." As he sings the country shuffle, his Waco accent gets even deeper on some of the verses, hiccuping the lines, "I'm gonna glow and grow till I'm so pure perfect." Toward the end of the set, he does a song called "Live Forever," and unknown to the audience, ends the song on his knees, hands at his side, head bowed in silence. With time for one more song, the show's host asks Billy Joe to play the title track from his latest album, Freedom's Child. "I would," says the singer, "but I'd rather do this one about Jesus. Like I say, if you don't love Jesus, go to hell. May the God of your choice bless you, and good luck with that." He and the band chug into "You Just Can't Beat Jesus Christ," the song Billy Joe ends almost every set with, whether he's playing on the radio in Texas or the stage in New York City. He sings it like a gospel singer would, answering the title's affirmation with ejaculations like, "Oh no, you can't." The show ends, and as soon as he is off the air, Billy Joe says to no one in particular, "I thank Jesus Christ every chance I get." "Aw, you're just buttering up the boss," responds Cornbread, his bass player. "I wouldn't kiss his ass," responds Billy Joe, "if I didn't have to." Then, after a pause, he adds, "And I have to." Billy Joe Shaver, David Allan Coe, Johnny Paycheck, Jerry Jeff Walker, Kris Kristofferson, Mickey Newberry, they were the boys with whom Willie and Waylon sang about going to Luckenbach, the so-called outlaws, the musicians and songwriters who, in the early 70s, revitalized country music by stripping it down and bringing it back to its roots. It was a hell of a crew, a wild bunch of drunks and crazies, and great songwriters. By most accounts, even Willie's, Billy Joe was the greatest. "Billy Joe is definitely the best writer in Texas," says the braided one. By most accounts, he was also the craziest. So it's fitting that his own life resembles a country song, though one that Hank Williams might have written if he'd collaborated with, say, Sophocles. The ballad of Billy Joe Shaver goes something like this. First verse. His father leaves before he's born, and he's raised by his grandmother while his mother waits tables in a honky-tonk. Second verse. He gets kicked out of the Navy, marries his pregnant girlfriend, and almost gets his right hand hacked off. Chorus. He's a screw-up and a scoundrel, drugs, booze, women, who someday, if lucky, will redeem himself. Third verse. He leaves his wife and becomes a successful Nashville singer and songwriter. He does more drugs and hits rock bottom. Fourth verse. He becomes born again and moves back to Texas, but he can't get a gig. His son joins his band, rejuvenating his career. Repeat chorus. Fifth verse. His son dies of a heroin overdose not long after his wife, whom he's remarried twice, and his mother die of cancer. he gives up music. Sixth verse. He decides to try again, but he has a heart attack on stage and almost dies. Alone in the world except for his songs, he goes back on the road. Repeat chorus, doubling the lines about the hope of redemption. Not only is Billy Joe's song true, but unlike almost everything coming out of Nashville these days, it has the ring of truth in all its glory and infamy. Billy Joe's life has imitated his art and vice versa for so long it's hard to tell where one starts and the other ends. He was born in Corsicana, a cotton gin town 50 miles southeast of Dallas, on August 16, 1939, to a laborer named Virgil and a woman named Victory, though by then Virgil was long gone. Victory left Billy Joe with his grandmother, Bertie Lee Watson, while she moved to Waco and went to work in a bar called the Green Gables. Bertie Lee was dirt poor, making lye soap for money, and raised Billy Joe and his older sister, Patricia, on her old age pension. He would go across the railroad tracks to the black settlement in Corsicana and listen to singers and guitar players. And at night, he would tune his radio to the Grand Ole Opry and Louisiana Hayride. Bertie Lee got him a guitar and told him, rocking him in a rocking chair, that someday he was going to play on the Opry, which was about as big as a Corsicana kid could dream. Billy Joe was a sensitive boy who wrote poetry and songs, and when he visited his mother in Waco, he would sometimes get up on the tables at the Green Gables and sing. He was also quick to anger and got in a lot of fights. He joined the Navy at 17, but was thrown out for punching an officer. He spent the next 6 months in a New Hampshire prison, and ultimately got his discharge changed to honorable. The officer was wearing civilian clothing, and he had hit Billy Joe first. He returned to Waco and married his teenage girlfriend, Brenda, after she got pregnant. He was tall and strapping, and found work picking cotton, roughnecking, and cowboying in a rodeo to support her and their baby son, Eddie. The couple fought a lot. Hellacious knockdown dragouts, Brenda once told an interviewer. At 21, he cut off most of two fingers and part of a third in a sawmill accident and had to pick them up and drive himself to a doctor who wasn't able to do much but stop the bleeding. The accident convinced Billy Joe that he wasn't suited for hard labor. I wouldn't ever have gone into music if I hadn't lost my fingers, he says now. It led to a bunch of weird dominoes falling in a weird order. The real-life country boy decided to become a professional songwriter, but he didn't know where to go or what to do. He had seen Willie Nelson play in clubs around Waco, and he eventually got up the nerve to talk to him. Willie wrote, "Good luck with your songs in Nashville," on a matchbox. And Billy Joe took that as a sign. In 1966, he took his guitar, songs, and Lady Killer's Smile and hitchhiked there, leaving Brenda, who didn't think he could make it in music, and Eddie behind. He and Brenda were soon divorced. Billy Joe soon returned to Waco, defeated by Music City's indifference, and spent the next several years traveling back and forth between Texas and Tennessee, eventually finding the courage to breach Nashville's inner circle. Once, he rode a motorcycle up on the front porch of songwriter Harlan Howard's publishing company and announced that he, Billy Joe Shaver, was the greatest songwriter who'd ever lived. Howard, a Nashville legend who had written classic songs such as I Fall to Pieces and Heartaches by the Number, invited him in for a drink. By 1968, Billy Joe had a job with singer-songwriter Bobby Bear's publishing company and began churning out songs. He got to know some of the other Nashville outsiders, guys like Christofferson, with whom he shared the handsome, scruffy, hippie poet M.O. And the wildlife suited him well. He did a lot of drinking, did a lot of drugs, and raised a lot of hell. Drugs, doping, smoking, women, he says, all kinds of drugs, speed, coke. I tried heroin once. The girl shot me up and it didn't do nothing. I was so goddamn crazy. I was crazier than any of them. I went for it. He stayed in touch with Willie, who invited him to play at his first 4th of July picnic, called the Dripping Springs Reunion, in 1972. After Billy Joe had played, he and some others were passing the guitar around backstage, singing songs. Billy Joe played one of his called Willie the Wandering Gypsy and Me. Waylon Jennings, who was often high on cocaine, liked it so much that he enthusiastically vowed to do a whole album of Billy Joe's cowboy songs. Billy Joe stalked Waylon for 6 months, reminding him of his drug-addled promise, finally cornering him in a Nashville studio where he was recording his next album. As Waylon explained to an interviewer a few years before he died, Billy Joe was drunk. He said, "You told me you was gonna do my goddamn songs. Now are you gonna do 'em, or am I gonna have to whip your ass?" Waylon eventually sat down and listened to the songs, which had titles like Honky Tonk Heroes and Old Five and Diners Like Me, and was astonished. This was soul music for rednecks. Loans from a honky tonk lifer, with simple melodies and emotional evocative words. Some were pure poetry. I've spent a lifetime making up my mind to be more than the measure of what I thought others could see, went the first lines of Old Five and Dimers Like Me. Some were just songs about ragged old trucks and one-night stands, but all were from Billy Joe's life, things he had done or dreamed about, so they sounded true. Waylon changed the course of his album right then. All but one song would be Billy Joe's. The resulting 1973 record, Honky Tonk Heroes, was the Nevermind the Bullocks, Here's the Sex Pistols of the outlaw country movement. All of a sudden, country was cool. String sections and sequins were out. Spare arrangements and blue jeans were in. The wet head was dead, and real men grew beards and long hair. Hippies mixed with rednecks, and Willie and Waylon became big stars. Soon came Redheaded Stranger and Luckenbach, Texas, and Wanted the Outlaws, the first Nashville platinum album. Forget that the term outlaw was thought up by a publicist, or that the notion of a gang of musicians hanging out and rebelling was just silly. The formula worked, and the songs were good. Especially Billy Joe's. After Heroes, he was covered by Christofferson, Bear, Tom T. Hall. Later came Elvis, the Allman Brothers, and John Anderson. They all heard the same thing in Billy Joe's writing. "His songs are so real," says Willie. And Texas, they're pieces of literature. Everything he writes is just poetry. Success bred even more excess for the wide-eyed rogue. Yet he also found himself drawn back to Brenda, whom he remarried. She moved to Nashville and became a hairstylist for, among others, the late Johnny Cash. In 1973, Billy Joe began releasing country albums of his own, starting with Old Five and Dimers Like Me, singing in his Central Texas baritone about living hard and raising hell, all with that lazy, stripped-down, pot-smoking country feel. He moved from label to label, Monument, Capricorn, Columbia, but his performing career never got off the ground, and he considered quitting the business. In 1977, after another typically wild Nashville night, he had a terrifying vision of a silent, disapproving Jesus. with eyes glowing like red coals, sitting on his bed. Billy Joe went walking and found himself on the top of a cliff, trying, he thinks, to kill himself. Instead, he says, he was saved by Jesus. On his way down, the words and melody to a new song, "I'm Just an Old Chunk of Coal," started coming to him. He moved the family to Houston and went cold turkey on all his vices, but by the end of the decade, he and Brenda were divorced again. His career by then seemed over, too. In the mid-80s, Billy Joe found a rejuvenation in an unlikely place, his broken home. Because of his wandering ways, his son Eddie had been raised mostly by Brenda. Now Eddie had grown up, and he was a gifted guitarist, a blues guy, and a rocker schooled by, among others, the Allman Brothers, Dickie Betts, who had given the boy a guitar when he was 12. Billy Joe started playing with his son, and Eddie co-produced his father's 1987 album, Salt of the Earth. Then, after Eddie spent time playing with the Allman Brothers, Dwight Yoakam and Guy Clark, father and son started their own band, Shaver, and created their own sound, a roadhouse boogie with honky-tonk twang. Billy Joe's career was reborn. Shaver began touring constantly. They also released 7 albums for 4 labels, including Tramp on Your Street in 1993, which sold more than 150,000 copies. The two grew their hair down to their shoulders, and with similarly coiffed drummers and bassists, Shaver looked like a Texas version of Lynyrd Skynyrd. "We were good," Billy Joe says, "probably too good. Every show we did was perfect." Some of his fans would say that this is a father's love talking. They thought his rocker son played too loud, too fast, and too often, stepping on the melodies and into the quiet spaces of Billy Joe's songs. Billy Joe didn't hear or didn't care. He was loyal to the son he had once neglected, and together they were creating something new. Their band was integral to the rise in the mid-90s of the Americana movement, rootsy, traditional country-influenced rock and roll, and so-called alt-country, which helped invigorate the careers of other old-timers too, especially Cash. It was a music for underdogs, and Billy Joe was the perfect saint for it, getting treated like a beloved grandfather by such magazines as No Depression. He was also discovered by new country acts like Pat Green, who covered his songs and proselytized about his influence. But Eddie was truly his father's son. He got hooked on heroin, an addiction he fought for years, and took a turn for the worse after his mother died of cancer in the summer of 1999. She and Billy Joe had remarried a second time in 1997. "He went into a tailspin," says Billy Joe. "They were like brother and sister. She was only 17 when he was born." On December 30th, 2000, Eddie was found in a motel room unconscious from an accidental overdose and was taken to the hospital. The next day, he died. He was 38. Shaver had a New Year's Eve show scheduled for that night at Pootie's Hilltop Bar and Grill in Spicewood. Billy Joe did it with help from Willie, who put a band together for him and wound up playing more than Billy Joe, who mostly sat in the audience, consoled by friends. "Your normal cowboy wouldn't even have attempted to do it," says Willie. Billy Joe is tough. They don't come much tougher. For Billy Joe, it was the longest night in a life full of them. "Please do not disturb," reads the handwritten note taped to the screen door of the unassuming brick ranch house in a South Waco suburb. "I haven't slept in 2 days, Billy Joe." The white paper is faded from 2.5 years' worth of Waco sun and rain. "It's been up since Eddie passed," he says on a warm June day as he opens the door. The inside is dark and cluttered, and the only life comes from two pit bulls. The dogs own it, he says. I just live here. The kitchen table is crowded with a fax machine and stacks of unruly papers. Tacked on the wall is a tour itinerary for the next 3 months. There are 40 dates, everything from a private party at the Y.O. Ranch near Kerrville to a show at the downtown Centennial Plaza in Midland to Willie's 4th of July picnic. Billy Joe spends a lot of time on the road with his band, most of whom are musicians half his age. It's a hard, unglamorous, and expensive life. In fact, Billy Joe loses money touring, taking his songwriting royalties and paying for the musicians, the van or bus, motels, and food. I pay to play, he says, but I love the road. Along the fireplace are small stone monuments sent by a fan with Billy Joe's lyrics inscribed on them. There are also various Indian artifacts, and above the mantle are photos of Eddie and Brenda, who died only 3 months after Victory died. The truth is, Billy Joe says, he's the one who should be dead. He was the one prone to fights and being in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people, doing something stupid because, well, that's just what you did when you were a hellraiser. We always figured I'd be the one to go first, he says. We figured I'd never live to see 40. I had insurance out the ass on me. Didn't buy it on either of them. Billy Joe's wife, the woman he married 3 times and divorced twice, was his muse. Every love song I've ever written was about her, he says. And as for his best friend and partner, Eddie, who died of the bad behavior his father had somehow navigated, Billy Joe is still devastated. He knew about Eddie's addiction, but figured his son would conquer it. I just assumed it would be all right, he says. He did probably look at me and say, if Dad can do it, I can too. After a long pause, Billy Joe sighs, you never get over it. One song the two wrote together, Live Forever, Eddie wrote the music, is a transcendent work that sounds like an old bluegrass hymn. I'm gonna live forever. I'm gonna cross that river. I'm gonna catch tomorrow now. You're gonna wanna hold me, just like I always told you. You're gonna miss me when I'm gone. Nobody here will ever find me, but I will always be around, just like the songs I leave behind me. I'm gonna live forever now. After Eddie died, Billy Joe actually quit writing songs for the first time in his life. He also lost the urge to perform. It wasn't until 6 months later, when his old friend Kinky Friedman persuaded him to join him for some Texas shows, that he got back on stage. During one of those performances at the hot, stuffy Green Hall on August 25th, 2001, Billy Joe got a collect call from God. It was a heart attack, live and on stage. Billy Joe remembers it well. I said, thank you, Lord, for letting me die in the oldest honky-tonk in Texas. I wanted to die. All this had happened, and I was going home to see Eddie, Brenda, and my mother. He survived and was then faced with a 3-week Australian tour with the pushy Friedman. I told him, I can't go. I had a heart attack. Kinky said, so what? You're going to ruin my career. So Billy Joe went. 2 days after coming home, he had quadruple bypass surgery. The songwriting finally started coming again last year after producer R.S. Field, who had helmed Tramp on Your Street, enticed Billy Joe to record again. He wrote a couple dozen songs, which were whittled to the 13 on Freedom's Child, a shimmering little autobiographical masterpiece, part country, part jangle. The album is proof that Billy Joe can still write a song. In fact, looking back over his work from the past decade, in some ways Billy Joe has actually gotten better as a writer as he has gotten older. Though he'll never top the youthful drive of I've Been to Georgia on a Fast Train, it's hard to imagine a more perfect love song than Star in My Heart, or a more perfect religious haiku than Son of Calvary, or a funnier send-up than Leavin' Amarillo. Screw you, you ain't worth passing through. All three written in his second half century. I think I was born to write songs, he says. That's why my eyes and ears are so open. But I can control it now. In the early days, I couldn't stop them. It was the master of me. Now I've mastered it. I'm a master songwriter. Now, as then, Billy Joe writes only about what he knows personally, yet he somehow takes the specific and makes it general. You don't have to have lost a son and a wife to feel the heartache of Day by Day, the story of his family on Freedom's Child. Many of his songs are mea culpas about the past, his irresponsibility, his neglect of people close to him, his pursuit of pleasures of the flesh. I've been a drifter and a low-life loser, he sings on Love Is So Sweet. You can learn a lot from me. Sometimes the old Billy Joe pops into one of his songs just long enough to seduce some woman or get in a fight. Part of his charm, at least in his songs, is that he keeps doing the bad stuff even though he knows it's bad. He's absolutely honest, Christofferson says. Clear-eyed, no guilt, not a bit of artifice. That's why his songs have lasted. Last year, Billy Joe finally got some recognition from the industry when, at the Americana Music Awards ceremony, he was given the first Lifetime Achievement Award for songwriting. It was, he said from the dais, the first award he'd ever received. And now, at an age when many of his peers are dead or retired, the wise old songwriter seems, as they say in showbiz, poised. He tours relentlessly with a great band. He's working on his autobiography with writer Brad Regan, and he's also working on a collection of poems. And then there's the documentary shot by Luciana Pedraza, an Argentinian horsewoman and tango dancer, with the help of her boyfriend, Robert Duvall. Duvall, who met Billy Joe in Texas during the filming of Lonesome Dove, cast him as a recovering alcoholic in The Apostle in 1997. Pedraza was fascinated by Billy Joe's life and songs. She spent 3 weeks following him around with a camera and even interviewed his 102-year-old English teacher, Mabel Legg, who recited from memory a few of his poems, including Space, which he wrote at 13. The documentary is done, and Pedraza says it will be out in February, in time for spring festivals. In the meantime, Billy Joe's life is defined by two things: playing and sitting around at home waiting to play. All roads lead away from Waco, and he longs to be on them. I love to travel, he says. I love to play. I love that freedom, the only free place I've got left. Last summer, Billy Joe played Willie's 4th of July picnic to about the same number of people he played to 31 years ago. Kids, bikini teens, college students with baseball caps turned backward, middle-aged women who sang along, men with gray beards who hollered and waved their hats. During Billy Bob Thornton's set before his, they chanted, "Billy Joe! Billy Joe!" The chant resumed as his band set up their amps. Billy Joe went to the lip of the stage, took off his hat, and waved at the crowd, his face set in a wide grin. Most stars wouldn't be caught dead on stage before showtime, but Billy Joe's fans are his last best hope. When the band started, he became like a great soul singer in a church of his own design, completely at ease, smiling, expansive, open to everything and everyone. He told funny stories and waved his hands like a preacher. He threw punches on honky-tonk heroes and got down on his knees and bowed at the end of Live Forever. He played You Just Can't Beat Jesus Christ and gave his Zen-like benediction. May the God of your choice bless you. It took him a while to get back to his bus after the show. In the backstage area, there were just too many people to hug, to reminisce with, and to hear words of solace from. He spent some time visiting with an old friend inside the bus, a man he hadn't seen in some time, another ex-drunk who had quit the wildlife to save his own and who told Billy Joe every detail. After a while, they said goodbye. I love you, brother. I love you too. And Billy Joe said, it's going to be all right. It's a 15-rounder, not a 12-rounder. Billy Joe went back outside and was stopped by two young women who had been looking for him for half an hour or so. They threw their arms around him, and he stood between them, hugging and laughing. Another woman, a little older, also approached and handed him a piece of paper she had written something on, which he put in his pocket. Soon a small crowd had gathered, old friends, musicians, backstage drifters, and he was surrounded, disappearing from view except for his brown hat, which seemed bowed in gratitude.
I'm gonna live forever, I'm gonna cross that river, I'm gonna kiss tomorrow now.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives.
Oh, play for mama.
We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 71 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
It's make-believe ballroom time. Put all your cares away. All the bands are here to bring good cheer your way. It's make-believe ballroom time, and free to everyone. It's no time to fret, your dial is set for fun. Just close your eyes and visualize in your solitude. Your favorite bands are on the stands, and Mr. Miller puts you in the mood. It's make-believe ballroom time. The hour of sweet romance. Here's your make-believe ballroom. Come on, children, let's dance, let's dance.
Hi, folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the make-believe ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S. as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello, world, and welcome to the ballroom, and thank you for joining me this hour as we listen to some wonderful swing, jazz, and big band music, as well as many of the stories behind the records I play. In just a moment, how two iconic big band leaders got their regal names.
But first, I haven't played any Charlie Barnett in some time, so I'm going to open the ballroom this week with Barnett and his Knocking at the Famous Door, recorded on the Bluebird label in 1939, direct from my Victrola turntable on the console here in the Crystal Studio.